Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, COVID cases continue their relentless rise. New infections are impacting schools, but they turn a blind eye to that in Union County, where the school board narrowly decides to keep masks optional. Mecklenburg County releases data on the vaccination rate for its employees, and in the wake of last week's release by the city of Charlotte of similar data, organizations representing police and firefighters are pushing back on any possible vaccine mandates for city workers. And Charlotte City Council begins the work of redrawing voting districts based on data from the 2020 census. Here to bring us up to date on those stories and more is WFAE's education reporter Ann Doss Helms. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Hunter Sines is here from WCNC-TV. Morning. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Nick Oxner is executive producer for investigations and the chief investigative reporter for WBTV. Good morning to you.
Hello, Mike.
Good morning. And Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for Roll Call and the host of their Equal Time podcast. Welcome back.
Hello, Mike.
Numbers don't lie, and all the numbers tell us that we have lost whatever control we thought we had over COVID-19. Almost all the cases we have in this country today are due to the Delta variant. The CDC says 97% of North Carolina cases are due to the Delta variant. Almost all of those becoming seriously ill from the Delta variant are unvaccinated. They account for 90% of North Carolina's hospitalized cases. This state reported 3,815 people hospitalized statewide on Thursday. That's double what it was a month ago, and a quarter of the people in the hospital are being treated in intensive care. That's higher than it was last winter at the supposed height of the pandemic. Now, some have been saying that this will all go away in October. Is that what experts are saying? I'm not sure who to ask that question of. Nick, go ahead.
I'll jump in. The models from the North Carolina Hospital Association show that this current wave that we're in is going to peak sometime between September and October. It's hard to get an exact and precise timeline on when this is going to peak because it depends on how many more people are going to get vaccinated. Are people going to travel or not travel? Basically, are people going to do the kinds of things we need to do to get this to go away? And unfortunately, I think we know the answer is probably not, just based on how we got in this predicament.
And we also had the big football games here last weekend, the college football games, which were considered potential super spreader events. And now they're asking people to wear masks to the opening game of the Panthers on Sunday, another possible super spreader event, even though it's outside. Airline travel is down from what they anticipated it would be, but people are still doing things over this Labor Day holiday. When we were considering reopening the economy, health officials in Mecklenburg said they wanted the COVID testing rate to be at about 5%. This week, it was at 15.8%. And we are fully open, except for mask mandates in Mecklenburg County. And again, most all of the cases are among unvaccinated people who are getting and helping to spread the virus. Where do we stand right now in the state, in Mecklenburg County, with vaccination rates?
I know the vaccination rates for the state are 51% of the entire state has been fully vaccinated, with 59% of eligible people who can get the vaccine are fully vaccinated. We have seen the rates of vaccinations go up even here locally over the past couple of weeks because of the concern of Delta variant. And I just think the increased messaging from health officials when you see the numbers, the hospitalizations, but it's still not where they want it to be. Clearly, this virus is still spreading. It's still increasing hospitalizations here locally and statewide. So a little bit more room to go, but we are slowly but surely getting more people vaccinated.
Dr. Anthony Fauci, who's the chief medical advisor to the president, among other things, reiterated this week that the danger of letting the Delta virus continue to spread through the unvaccinated population is not just a danger to them, but a danger to us all, because it gives more opportunity for the virus to mutate and perhaps become something that these vaccines cannot deal with. Is that reason enough to mandate, as the president did yesterday, so many people get the vaccine? I mean, he said all the federal workers, anybody doing business with the federal government, has to mandate that their employees and companies over 100 get vaccinated. Have we reached that point?
Well, it's really difficult to mandate things for private employers. He is saying there will be mandates for vaccines for federal employees. But you do see, you know, in South Africa, we have that new variant, which really reiterates what Dr. Fauci has been saying about new opportunistic variants. And even though North Carolina is doing okay, as Hunter said, you know, South Carolina is much looser, and we're right next door. You know, I was on a plane this past weekend, and it was packed. So we do have these different mandates with different states doing quite well, like in New England, and others doing terribly, particularly among the unvaccinated.
But as the president said yesterday, this vaccine does not know borders. Everybody has to, and he was talking about state borders, but here we are, people traveling from country to country, and although some countries won't let Americans in, and we won't let some other countries in, he makes a great point. And yet, right after his speech yesterday, Governor Henry McMaster in South Carolina proclaimed through Twitter that he would fight to the gates of hell, his words, for the freedom of South Carolinians. What planet are we on?
It's a planet, apparently, where some elected officials have forgotten that we already have vaccine mandates to go to school for lots of other vaccines. I mean, all of us here got vaccinated so that we could go to school. Mike, I don't know if they had vaccines when you went to elementary school, but when I went to elementary school, I had to be vaccinated on a whole host of things. And now we have a COVID-19 vaccine made by Pfizer that's fully approved by the FDA. It's not an emergency use authorization. It's run the gamut. It's fully approved, just like all the vaccines that we have to take for everything else. And so that's why I think there's a little bit of disconnect between all the other vaccines we got to get and this.
People don't remember there were people in iron lungs.
That's right.
We had polio and all these other illnesses. So I think, you know, and people were begging for something to help. And we all remember in school having to do this. And it's as though folks don't remember there was a time when
we
had so many illnesses running rampant and that could return. I mean, you do see now parents of children who are immunocompromised or have conditions, cancer and so forth, really having a backlash to the backlash because they're saying you're putting everyone in danger and right. It's a community issue.
They don't remember this. Mary, you're not as old as I am, and I'm as old as all of you combined. But I do remember when the polio vaccine came out, the Jonas Salk vaccine, which was a shot in the arm, and how excited people were about that shot becoming available because kids were succumbing and being put in iron lungs and dying and being paralyzed by polio, which we don't even think about today. And then they were equally excited by the Sabin vaccine for polio, which came out later. It was put into a sugar cube. And even that excited kids because they got to eat sugar cubes.
And measles, mumps, chicken pox.
Yes.
I remember all of those. You know, I got them and then the vaccine came out and people.
A lot of us
really
would be
much.
Dead today were it not for these vaccines. And we have forgotten it because they're completely invisible right now because of the vaccines. I don't understand it, but maybe this will wake some people up. Clearly, so far, it has not. Yesterday, the president announced those changes. He announced that federal employees and contractors must get vaccinated, and it covers about two-thirds of all American workers. How much of this is likely to face court challenges? You're the court guy, Nick Oxner. Do you think this is going to be ending up in court?
Well, we know it is because a bunch of Republican governors have already said they'll challenge it in court. I do think it is, I'll call it novel, concept for the government to mandate private employers mandate something from people, right? It's different than you have to be vaccinated to go to school. That's, you know, the government can do that, I guess, if they want.
But wasn't there a Supreme Court ruling on another case several years ago that the general public welfare and health outstrips your individual rights?
Yeah, and I think obviously the Biden administration would not have taken the step if they didn't feel that they had a solid legal ground to stand on. That being said, we all know solid legal grounds don't mean that people won't challenge them.
And you, Nick, reported yesterday on the summer surge of COVID-19 hospitalizations in the state. You spoke with a woman by the name of Kat Phillips, a nurse in the surgical ICU at the UNC Medical Center, who said the patients are a lot sicker than they were in the past and a lot younger. And she also confirmed the majority of them are unvaccinated. And in some places, hospitals are in dire circumstances in terms of staff shortages, hospital bed shortages, exhaustion of staff, et cetera. How do things stand here?
Yeah, not good. And this was a statewide survey of all hospitals in North Carolina that we did as part of the North Carolina Watchdog Reporting Network. And what we got back, we asked hospitals a number of questions designed to gauge the impact this surge is having on them and their operations. And what we got back were answers that were not good. Hospitals having to go back to delaying or canceling elective surgeries, hospitals that are having to divert patients or refuse transfer patients because they don't have the capacity to care for them. Because, Mike, these people are getting sicker with COVID and they're staying in the hospital longer, 9 to 20 days right now for a COVID patient. That's compared to 3 to 5 days hospitalization for a non-COVID patient. So it's filling up ICU beds, which is keeping ER beds full. And that impacts all of us because when we have a broken bone or some other ailment that we need to go to the ER, they don't have room to care for us. And it is a real problem.
And at some point, the bill for all this will come due, and this is costing hundreds of millions of dollars, and some of it will go to insurance companies who will raise our copays and our premiums to pay for this, because they're not going to pay for it, or taxes will have to go up to pay for all the hospitals that suffer a lack of payment from people who don't have insurance. We have to take a break. We'll come back with more. We'll talk about COVID in the schools and what's happening there. It's Charlotte Talks and the Local News Roundup on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks and the Local News Roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Ann Doss Helms is here. She's our education reporter at WFAE News. Hunter Science reports for WCNC. Nick Oxner for WBTV. And Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for Roll Call and host of their Equal Time podcast. Among the most at risk from this COVID virus, of course, are young people too young to be vaccinated. That would be young people under 12. Los Angeles is set to become the first major school district in the country to mandate coronavirus vaccinations for students 12 and older. But here, masks are the only mandated protection, and all but 3 school districts in North Carolina have mandated wearing masks in the classroom and in school buildings by teachers and students and staff. Yet we still have COVID clusters breaking out, Anne. Is that because of what individuals are doing outside of school?
Well, there are two different things. There are people who are in schools who get it out in the community, and the vast majority of numbers we're seeing are apparently that. If you're seeing literally a cluster, which is the state's list where they say 5 or more cases in a school, that means that the local health officials have ruled that those cases are connected, that there is some spread within the school. So yes, even with the mandates, the number of clusters and the number of quarantines is not zero because, you know, people take masks down to eat. There are sports events. They are saying now that a huge number of the school clusters and the school cases are connected with athletics, where you may be outside, you may be inside, but there's more leeway for spread, and it is happening.
Talk to me for a second about quarantines. What happens if a student reports that they have COVID or tests positive for COVID, or if a teacher tests positive for COVID? What happens, and who decides who goes into quarantine, and for how long are you in quarantine, and does that vary from district to district?
So last year, if you were exposed, you had to go home, and I think it was for 14 days. There's some wiggle room in there. But this year they said, okay, masks are so effective that we are going to change this. So they didn't make it stricter. They actually made it more lenient. So if everybody was consistently wearing masks, specifically the person with the COVID or the positive test and the person who had close contact, the close contact can stay in school until they start to show any symptoms. In that case, you know, everybody agrees. If you got symptoms, go home. But
if you are asymptomatic, you can also spread the virus.
You can, and that's why they're saying they believe the masks provide enough protection that, and they everybody is saying the quarantines and the Delta variant, there are a lot of variables in here. We don't have 100% absolute knowing that this is exactly the right balance, but this is the balance they've struck, that if I've got my mask on and I'm asymptomatic, even though I might have it, it's worth the benefit of being in school. Because with this Delta variant, if you send home everybody who gets close contact, the numbers in quarantine get really high really quickly. And so you've got a lot of kids missing school, and we have even less support for them than we had last year when everybody had remote plans in place.
Right. So you keep saying that the masks are good protection, and they are, but there are still three districts in North Carolina that don't mandate masks. So what happens in those cases? If a child or a teacher tests positive, do they have to leave school? Can they come back in with a mask? What's the story there, or do you know?
So if you test positive, you do have to go home until, you know, and I don't know quite what all the process is, but if one of my classmates tests positive and masks are optional, so we're not consistently wearing them, then somebody at that school has to figure out everybody who had 15 minutes or more of close contact with that student, and they have to go home. And in Union County, they spent a lot of time arguing over how quickly they could come back, because there are more than 5,000 students. I think it was about 5,200 as of last Friday's snapshot. They haven't updated yet today, but that's a lot of kids. I mean, it's a big district, but that's still one out of every
eight
kids.
One in eight students in Union County.
Yeah, was at home. And as the board chair pointed out, you know, we don't know that they're sitting at home, you know, studying and sitting in their bedroom quietly. In fact, we probably assume with a lot of the teenagers, they're out mingling in the community and potentially being more exposed and exposing more people. So everybody agreed this is a really bad thing.
Do we know what's happening in private schools?
We know that there have been some clusters listed. It is just, you know, the energy that it takes to track what's going on in every single school. And even within the public districts, everybody reports their data differently. So it's really frustrating if you want to be able to see an apples to apples comparison to say things are better or worse in Union County where masks are not mandated versus, you know, say a Charlotte Mecklenburg schools where they are mandated. Everybody reports their data differently.
Why?
Well, they're just, and this was true last year also, but last year when they went to the in-person with minimal distancing, the governor said, you can go to this, but you have to report your data to this ABC Science Collaborative out of Duke University, which generated a lot of the data that they used to come up with this year's plan, which basically said, look, we need to have kids in school. That all that remote learning and all that, you know, extreme distancing, so they had to go in shifts, that was not worth it. We, as long as we have kids in there with masks on, it is better for them to be in school. Hmm. So that collaborative now, when that expired, nobody in North Carolina is required to report their data to that collaborative now. So they say now instead of 100 district reporting, they have 20 that are doing it voluntarily. So there is actually less data being generated as we go through this whole new mix.
So I think I'm correct in saying that there are no vaccine mandates in place in any of the schools yet. Is that correct for teachers and staff?
That is correct to my knowledge. I suppose it's remotely possible that some private school might, but no, that's definitely not a big thing.
So the only protection that teachers have and that students have are the masks. And it's not every school district in North Carolina mandates the masks. There are three that do not, among them Union County, where the school board revisited their original decision to make masks optional this past week, and they still decided to make them optional. Despite the 50-some hundred students in quarantine, one in eight students in quarantine, they will have to revisit that decision next month because a new state law mandates that school boards revisit their mask-wearing decisions once a month. And we do know there was significant educational regression as a result of a year of online education. Why hasn't the fact that one in eight students are in quarantine in Union County registered as a problem among school board members who have a responsibility to provide the best education possible for the students in their care?
It has absolutely registered as a problem. Everybody was in agreement that this is bad, we need to do something about it, but there is a contingent in Union County and probably everywhere, but it's very prominent in Union County. And I just spoke with one of the founders of Moms for Liberty there, and she said, they keep acting like masks are not harmful. Masks are, you know, it's not a neutral trade-off. It's not just an inconvenience. They firmly believe there are psychological, emotional, physical, like rashes, and some people even talk about breathing in the carbon dioxide.
Is there any scientific evidence to back that up?
Well, as far as emotional impact, I think that's really hard to measure. But no, every public health agency that I've looked at says there are no significant health risks. There may be, you know, rashes, acne. The ABC Collaborative says, yes, that can happen, but it won't kill you like COVID might. So every public health agency, every doctor I've spoken with has said the masks are such a small price to pay for the protection you get. And it's not 100% protection. It's not perfect, but it's significant.
And in the only protection that kids under 12 have, Union County School Superintendent Andrew Houlihan is in favor of a mask mandate.
Whether I agree or disagree or accept or don't accept, I think the one strategy left that we have that will ensure that more of our kids stay in school is a mask requirement.
So he urged it of the school board. Union County health officials also urged a mask mandate, but the Union County School Board Chair Melissa Merrill said teachers, employees, and parents should have the freedom to decide for themselves about masks.
I voted for one thing, the teachers, the employees, and the parents that asked me to please allow them freedom of choice and not do a universal mandate.
Now, I'm told that only 99 students have been sickened from COVID in Union County. Could the county or the school system, however, be held liable should somebody get really sick or, God forbid, die as a result of this?
Well, they spent a lot of time in closed session with their attorneys, and there have been conversations going on. So I don't want to try to weigh in with the legality on that. The 99 number is interesting and also a little bit murky because the health director did not come to this meeting. He was apparently invited and did not come. And they instead insisted on having a private meeting. So what we had was Melissa Merrill, the board chair, interpreting what she says she was told, which was that out of those 5,200 who were sent home, 99 of them tested positive. Because that's a big question. Are we sending home kids who are just about to get COVID, which is good, we want them out of the way, or are we sending home people who are never going to get COVID, so we wasted their educational time? I think there are a lot of follow-up questions. You know, if these kids were sent home yesterday and they haven't tested positive yet, you know, that's not a, they're just, every data point raises more questions.
Yeah.
So that is a question. But like Dr. Houlihan said, you know, they kept saying there is a way to cut this number down dramatically, and that is the masks. And that just became the question, is how much do you want to preserve that choice? And it's worth noting that in July, the Union County Board voted unanimously to make masks optional, of course, at a time when the numbers were a lot lower. In August, they voted 7-2, and this vote was 5-4. So I think there's going to be a lot of lobbying going on, hoping to flip that by at least one vote.
Well, there's been a lot of studies, too. I mean, there was a teacher who taught without a mask, and a lot of her students came down with it. The kids in the front row came down with it most. The middle of this, it's fewer, and then in the back, fewer. And I heard a national teacher's official say, listen, everybody agrees they want students back in the classroom for the learning experience. That is not a conflict. It's just that teachers, staff, and a lot of parents are concerned because they just don't want their kids to get sick.
Iredell Statesville schools opened with masks optional, but after temporarily closing their sixth school because of COVID, their superintendent recommended that masks be mandated. Anne, has that happened?
Yes. Everybody else except Union County in our region has now mandated masks. And it was in early August, it was the opposite. It looked like CMS was going to be the outlier requiring masks. So, and you know, we have kind of a natural experiment over at Union Academy in Monroe, ironically, in Union County, opened, you know, essentially with masks optional. They said they were mandatory, but you could just ask for an exemption. So, and they saw not just their quarantines, which their quarantines were atrocious, but they saw their cases get really high as kids came in. And they have now seen those, because they started earlier, they've had a few weeks now with masks mandatory, and their new case levels It's not zero. Again, they're having some, but it's much, much lower.
And the rules for churches are changing in, I think, Mecklenburg County. Is that correct, Hunter? Do you know about this?
Yes, that is correct, or that is the plan right now. So basically, the county board voted 5-4, a very close vote, to change the mask indoor mandate that Mecklenburg County has to where it will now be in effect at religious institutions during worship services. However, it's unclear. They haven't drafted it yet. And so we're waiting to hear what that includes. Does that include just church services or funerals and weddings? So there could be big implications here, but it was a big divide on the county board just because of the separation of church and state, freedom of religion. We know that the gathering limit that was put on in the governor's executive order early on in the pandemic was struck down by a court. So we anticipate that there could be legal challenges here, but we're going to have to wait and see. It could go into effect on October 1st. That's 10 days after the release of the draft, which by law they have to do.
Are churches pushing back on this, or and not churches, just churches, synagogues, sure, and mosques?
Yeah, I personally have not heard of any pushback yet, but it is anticipated. Remember, this is still being drafted right now. I believe they still have to take a vote on September 21st of the final draft language, and then to put it into effect. But a lot of commissioners who voted for this reminded everyone that one of the biggest outbreaks was, or the largest outbreaks here in Mecklenburg County, was at United House of Prayer with 200 plus cases and 12 deaths. So there's this whole, let's be equal. Churches shouldn't have a right to just get out of this mask mandate.
And when you think about it, churches are like incubators in a sense. You're all worshiping, fellowship, singing, praying. You know, I know they are skeptical, even some who are for, because of the separation between church and state, but yeah.
Okay, when we come back from the break, the lightning round, the release of employee vaccination data in Mecklenburg County, the resistance on the part of police and fire organizations, and then it was a very deadly week in Charlotte with a very unfortunate incident, which we'll talk about as well at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on the Local News Roundup on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Nick Oxner's here from WBTV News. Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call. Hunter Sines from WCNC-TV and Ann Doss Helms from WFAE News. We talked last week about the data released by the city of Charlotte about vaccination rates among its employees. This week, Mecklenburg County released similar data. What did it show?
So it showed that about 70% of county employees have been fully vaccinated, which is higher than the city's and which is higher than the rates that we have here in Mecklenburg County as a community at large. But it is worth noting that one of the departments that also has the lowest amount of vaccination rates is the Sheriff's Department, which, as we all know, there have been multiple outbreaks at the jail. So it's still this pattern of our first responders, our front-facing employees, still having the lowest vaccination rates. So the county is now mandating that you show proof. And then, of course, weekly testing for those who are unvaccinated will take effect here soon.
Firefighters also are among the groups with the lowest vaccination rates. And last week, three organizations representing Charlotte Police, Charlotte Firefighters, and the Charlotte chapter of the Public Service Workers Union sent a letter to the mayor and to the city manager opposing the possibility of a COVID-19 vaccine mandate for city employees. Julian Ortiz is a spokesperson for the Fraternal Order of Police in Charlotte. She says that although the union is encouraging members to get the shot, they don't want a mandate.
There's a lot of people out there that believe the vaccine is what's going to bring the pandemic to the end. And there's other people who believe that that vaccine will harm their body. And we just want people to be comfortable in their decision. And I think a mandate is not necessary.
Belief is one thing. Scientific fact is another. The facts say the vaccines are safe and effective. There have been no serious side effects from any of the vaccines. And as for the necessity of mandates, last week the vaccination rate at CMPD was, I think, 63%. Charlotte Fire was 49%. Once again, Hunter, these are frontline workers. Shouldn't they be vaccinated for their own safety and for the safety of the people they're serving?
I would definitely echo that sentiment. And you have to, I think the big question to ask is, okay, if you don't want a mandate, then do you want to lose your hazard pay? It's taxpayer money that people are getting, these frontline workers are getting. And so, you know, there could be an argument that it's one or the other, because the city, the county have put in safety precautions, they put in this hazard pay, and still the one thing that can protect you the most is not wanting to be taken in the arm by these frontline workers.
And in fact, the letter written by those three organizations almost makes the case for a vaccine mandate. It states, quote, "Combined, our organizations represent and speak for thousands of workers in this city. And that means that thousands are at risk and putting others at risk." And again, they make the argument for individual choice. How do communities, cities, governments decide when public safety overrides personal choice? How did we decide that seatbelts needed to be worn, or helmets for bicycles and motorcycles needed to be worn, or that polio shots needed to be had? How do you decide all this?
And I mean,
how
it's
is
a tough,
this different?
It's a tough decision. I don't, to the vaccine portion, I don't think it is different. I mean, when Nick was talking, we were talking about earlier about how we had all these vaccines that are mandated for when you go to school. I don't think it's much different. I think what's most frustrating, at least from a reporter standpoint, who covers this stuff, and I'll go out on a limb here, is it needs a leader with more of a backbone. You know, from the governor just keeping it up to local school districts to decide on a mask mandate or mask optional, somebody has to decide who is an elected leader of which way to go. And I think that's the biggest point here, is you're either going to do it or you're not going to do it. But clearly, the status quo is not really working.
Those of us who have,
you're afraid enough when you get stopped by a police officer or a traffic stop or right. something, and then you have to ask, are you vaccinated before you talk to me? You know, and as far as the governor is concerned, Hunter, you know, it's interesting, but Cooper is very different from some of the Republican governors like Abbott in Texas or DeSantis in Florida, who are actually proactively forbidding any of these things. So I guess we're in a middle ground.
Those of us who have had the privilege of interviewing politicians know that most of them are expert tap dancers. But when it comes to this, tap dancing is not helpful. And I haven't found a single politician that I've talked to at any level who has done anything but trip the light fantastic. Let me mention a name here. Isaiah Figueroa. We should remember his name.
Isaiah. 3 years old, lost his life because we can't figure out how to live together.
Mayor Vialiles, Charlotte Mayor Vialiles, and she added, if we can't figure this out for a three-year-old, for whom will we do this? Isaiah Figueroa was killed and his four-year-old sister injured when a shooter blanketed their house. This is unbelievable. With a barrage of 150 bullets that went on for at least a minute in a midnight attack on Tuesday. And police believe that his killing is tied to the fatal shooting of a teenager and several other recent gunshot attacks on Charlotte homes, which are believed to be related to disputes among kids at Hopewell, North Mecklenburg, and Chambers High Schools. CMPD Chief Johnny Jennings posed a thought-provoking question in the aftermath of these shooting sprees.
How can you wake up this morning knowing that your actions last night took the life of a three-year-old who will never get the opportunity to grow up and play and have fun as you've had that opportunity?
What else do we know about either this shooting or the disagreement alleged to be at the center of these shootings? What else do we know? Not much. Kate emails as the parent of a North Mex student who saw multiple young black men being escorted by police to the cars to be searched on Thursday. What I don't understand is what CMPD was trying to accomplish by telling the community that the shooters were students at Hopewell, North Mech, and Chambers. It caused hysteria and panic among students, understandable, and parents, many of whom didn't even have kids at these schools, made everyone feel less safe, put a target for harassment and profiling on all young men of color. About half the student body at North Mech didn't come to school on Thursday. How was releasing that information helpful? What were they trying to accomplish? Do we have an answer to that question?
This is the ultimate no-win situation, because can you imagine if the police department and or CMS had withheld that information and something had happened at a school? I mean, I totally understand why they're saying, please speak up and tell us if you know anything. On the other hand, can you imagine the stress of trying to teach or of trying to figure out whether you should report something, knowing that there is violence out there, but also knowing, as this person points out, all three of these schools are majority black and Hispanic. And by saying, yes, we need reports, you are potentially setting up a situation where this blanket of suspicion falls broadly. And it is absolutely positively true that the majority of students at all of these schools are not, you know, involved in this gunfire. So, but I just can't imagine not speaking up as either a school district or a police department, because I think families would feel like they need to know if there is potentially.
CMS Superintendent Ernest Winston told reporters yesterday the school system is aware of threats and rumors on social media against schools and is ramping up security and working to curb teen violence, but at the same time, he urged caution.
We ask that you speak with your children. That's important. We know that there are rumors and threats that are swirling, and it can be frightening. I'm a parent myself. I get it. Every situation is different. So please be patient while staff is evaluating every specific situation.
So very quickly, these threats, are these threats from anonymous sources against the schools because of the violence that has been perpetrated? What specifically is he talking about?
I don't know. I'm not sure that anybody has released.
Yeah, it's murky, maybe driven by social media. And there's not been a lot of hard detail, which I think has just made the fear that much greater.
Well, Charlotte has hired these violence interrupters to try to get at this violence at the root, because when you look at these kids spraying, that it was as though it was a game, and it was just so shocking. So they're hoping to get it at the root.
Tomorrow is the 20th anniversary of 9/11 and the attacks by hijacked commercial jetliners on the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and the plane that went down in a field in Pennsylvania. WFAE Sarah D'Elia spoke with two 9/11 survivors now living in Charlotte. Kathleen Britton had moved from Charlotte to New York to work for Merrill Lynch. She lived in a condo near the World Trade Center, saw the towers collapse, and helped with the cleanup.
The dust was so thick, and there were pieces of letters and plane tickets and photographs and train tickets and just pieces of people's lives, the things that had been on their desk, littered everywhere.
Peter Blaisch served with the New York City Fire Department and was a first responder in New York that day. He has often been asked what it was like.
And I say, well, have you ever been to 43 funerals in the course of 18 months? Most people don't go to 43 funerals in that lifetime. And these were all people I knew and worked with and were friends and in my wedding party. So I said, that kind of puts into perspective what you kind of went through on a personal level.
He retired from NYFD after 25 years, moved to North Carolina, and became a volunteer firefighter in Cornelius. On Saturday, he will participate in a remembrance held by the department. But he has his own ritual every year on the anniversary when he pauses at 3:43 p.m., to remember the 343 firefighters who died. Peter Blaisch says spending time with his family has helped him through all of this.
So that kind of regenerates me a lot, is when I spend time with my kids and it's like, okay, every day doesn't have to be 9/11. You know, you can have good points in your life, you know. We tend to dwell on the bad stuff, but we all have good stuff.
And it wasn't just those who died on September 11th, 2001, who have suffered, and their families too. There are the men and women of our armed forces who went to Iraq and Afghanistan in the aftermath and who never came home. And we mustn't forget the families they left behind. Nick, you lost your father in Afghanistan. He served four tours of duty there, and you recently wrote a piece for CNN in which you say you're sad and angry and that we should be too. But what you're angry about, if I read the piece correctly, is the years of mismanagement of the war and the way the war ended, but also about how those back home who went from waving flags and supporting the troops to forgetting that they were there at all. And you ask, what can our country do to be worthy of their sacrifice? Do you have an answer?
I don't have an answer, because I think that's up to all of us to write that answer. It's been heartening in the last month or so to see the country turn its attention back to Afghanistan as we withdraw and try to resettle Afghans who've fled their country out of fear for their safety. But at the same time, it's hurtful and disappointing because it serves as a reminder of the at least decade or more in which people forgot we were still fighting in Afghanistan in the first place. 9/11, for me, very personal thing. I lived at Fort Bragg. My dad was in Green Beret training on 9/11 and went to Afghanistan for the first time in 2002. I recount some of that in that essay in CNN. And it changed the trajectory of my family's life forever. But it was a sacrifice my family made. My dad died doing what he loved and was happy to be and proud to be defending our country.
And I don't have a lot of time left, but I think this needs to be mentioned because of the tens of thousands of Afghans who helped us during our efforts there and who are in danger now and who we've didn't do a very good job of helping get out of the country. You talk about the respect and love that your father had for these people and they for him. In fact, one of them wrote your family after your father died.
Yeah, 100%. My dad's closest translator, he served all four tours in roughly the same place. So he worked with a guy named Ayub, who was his translator. And these are people who have sacrificed, in some cases, their lives, certainly their safety and security and service to America and helping Americans in exchange for the understanding that we would one day help them get safely out of the country. The State Department has now confirmed that we left hundreds of thousands of Afghans who thought they would come back to America. They've left them in Afghanistan under the rule of the Taliban, which, as we see, is increasingly hardline, and their safety is in jeopardy because they helped the American public.
You come from a military family. You were at Fort Bragg when your father was deployed the first time. Your wife is in the military right now. It's difficult, if not impossible, to withdraw from a war in an orderly fashion, particularly if you did not win the war. So there's been a lot of criticism about this. What would you say to Americans, only 1% of which serve in our military and therefore have a very tangential relationship to it, about future wars and conflicts?
Wars have an extremely high cost. They cost lives. Death is a cost of war. And in this case, my father's death was the cost of our war in Afghanistan. Sometimes, though, they're necessary to defend your country and to defend freedom. And hopefully, they're not necessary very often. But I think to most people, the true cost and real cost of war is an abstract thought and doesn't have very real consequence. And so as we talk about war, people should remember families like mine. They should take a trip to Arlington National Cemetery and go to Section 60, where my dad's buried. And they should understand that those costs are real and meaningful and tangible.
And yet your father re-upped three times.
He had been in the Army 18 years at the time that he was killed. That's all he wanted to do in his life.
Well, thank you for his service. And I'm sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
We will remember that tomorrow on September the 11th. Nick Oxner from WBTV, Hunter Sines from WCNC-TV, Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call, and Ann Doss Helms from WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.